Hello, and welcome to another edition of Barbarians at the Gate. My name is Jeremiah Jenny, broadcasting high above the Dongcheng district of Beijing. With me in the studio for the first time, and it feels like a long time, my co-host David Moser.
Good to see you in person, Jeremiah.
I know, you've been traveling a lot.
Been traveling a lot. Just got back from the big AAS convention, Association of Asian Scholars, in Seattle this year. Saw a lot of people I haven't seen in really 10 years because COVID really just knocked out 3 years, maybe even four for most people. And I did not even attempt to attend online because that's so boring. I mean, a little secret, I go to AAS not because of the talks. I go to do the networking. And I think that's what most people are there for. I mean, some of the talks were great. You had Ian Johnson talking about his Sparks book with some different people than you normally see. Ran into our friend Kaiser Guo. Ran into lots of people. Some of my old friend, my Tongxue from Michigan that I hadn't seen in a long time. So it was great. The downside is the flight back, I think, was about 18 hours because there are very few direct flights from the U.S. to China now. So I have a case of jet lag like I've never had before in my life. And I've ran out of things to say because my brain just stopped working.
That's never stopped me.
As we shall soon see.
Indeed. And with us today in the studio is John Alekna, a historian of information technology and politics in modern China, currently on the faculty at the History of Science, Technology, and Medicine Department at Peking University in Beijing. He's joining us today to talk about his new book, Seeking News, Making China, Information Technology and the Emergence of Mass Society. How you doing, John? And I love the Red Sox hat.
I'm doing great. I'm very excited to be here with both of you today. I wasn't able to make it to AAS this year, so being able to talk with two China scholars around this table today is a great opportunity to kind of make up for the connections that I miss by being over here in Beijing, but also a great way to establish a bigger community here in Beijing.
It does sort of feel like one of the challenges is you were saying how long it's been since you've been to AAS. And I was just curious, we do kind of feel like we're starting to move into kind of separate academic orbits here, right? A little bit. Were there a lot of scholars from this side of the Pacific?
No. I mean, I was thought of as a kind of a freak show. It's like, what? What are you doing there? And in fact, you know, one of the reasons I went there is my school is trying to get a 2-year free master's program going. So, of course, I was doing some networking and meeting up with some people and see if they can promote it. And people were surprised that there's even any interest, that it's even possible to get students back in China. It turns out to be really easy to get teachers back in China because, you know, a lot of people would love John's job to be there teaching, you know, and have a visa and have a lot of freedom to do research. There's a crying need for people to get back here and continue their research and reestablish their contacts. But there is not a crying need on the U.S. side to get students back. Quite the contrary. The students are really reticent. Parents are, you know, worried about China. China has a horrible reputation. The State Department puts out these warnings about, you know, China is a country where you could be extra legally detained and put in jail and all this kind of stuff. Of course, people don't want to go. And that, in all my conversations, that was very clear. Like, are you crazy? You want to start a school program? No one's going to go. It is feeling that like we're kind of on another planet here.
And this is really such a shame because work like this book came out of years and years of going through those types of programs, doing the study abroad as an undergrad, a master's program, being able to come over on Fulbright research, being able to...
Which doesn't exist now, right?
And if we're not getting those young kids coming into the undergraduate exchange programs, we're not going to get books like this 15 years down the line.
Let's talk about the book. I mean, you know, one of the things I thought maybe it'd be useful is that for those of us who don't focus specifically on the technology of communications, I think of communications, I almost immediately think of the content. Before we get into the specific situation in China, maybe talk a little bit more, like, why is technology so important when we're really looking at the history of communication, communication, media and the way information travels around a society and around the world?
Well, I think technology is really central to the ways in which society and politics organize itself. So although we can't understand technology as being separate from culture or being separate from politics, they're really intertwined with one another. The possibilities of social organization and the possibilities of political organization are really tied up with the extent to which technology unites people in different areas, in different classes, with different sorts of personal characteristics. So we might in our everyday life think that things like propaganda and things like the content of information are the primary, most important thing about one's media environment. But in fact, a much more fundamental and perhaps even more important thing is the underlying technological infrastructure. And this underlying technological infrastructure allows things like ideology, ideas, political movements to emerge. If you don't have that underlying infrastructure, you can't have what Marx would call the superstructure.
So yeah, I was okay. When I think of technology, though, and I in the context of this of the history of communications, I'm thinking in terms of like the Western experience. You know, there were newspapers, and right. they invented the nation, and then yeah. there was a radio, and there were fireside chats, and then you know, sometime in the middle of the 20th century, there was David, you know, as a kid with his two little toy guns at his holster, watching like the first TV series and TV shows.
You had to make me a representative of the mid 20th century. Thanks, Jeremiah.
And then there was the late 20th century, as I was sitting on the floor watching, you know, the A-Team, and then we had the internet, and that's kind of how this works, right? I mean, one of the things about your book that really strikes me is that the technology seems similar, but that trajectory feels so different when we look at it from the lens of China's development.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I think is so interesting about looking at China, not only through technology, but also through many other aspects of its culture and its history, is that it offers us a very different way to understand the emergence of modernity. So in this case, we don't see that stadial, stage-like development, which you describe, where we move from the newspaper in Victorian England to the radio with Roosevelt in a fireside chat to Kennedy and Nixon on television and the internet today. Instead, we see a much different interpretation of this process, which doesn't necessarily involve large-scale newspapers, which is more public than private. And this difference, I think, really inflects a lot of the ways in which Chinese politics develops over the course of the 20th century. But overall, this is extremely important that we recognize that there is no set path, that technology doesn't make us do certain things and develop in a certain way. In fact, we can choose, because of culture, because of political decisions, to take technology and therefore it's the society it creates in different directions. Mm-hmm. And this is what China tells us.
Dive into where the book starts with the May 4th movement. For me, it was very fascinating. We've read so much about the May 4th movement, but I never really thought about really that much, you know, how the information was spread and how long it took. Another one part of, I think it was in that chapter, something that the light dawned on me, why I've always thought jiao tong, that word in Chinese, can either mean communications or it means traffic. Mm. And I always thought, well, that's just one of those cases where languages blur two concepts. Right. But in reading that chapter, I realized that those two, that communications and travel, traffic, you know, were, you know, tied up together because, as you give an account of, a lot of people are listening to a radio broadcast, but copying it down, transcribing it, and much of the information had to travel from one place to the other in physical form.
Yeah.
Can you just kind of, for people, I'm sure people would find it interesting, you know, can you kind of describe how the May 4th movement, the information about the Japanese and all that stuff, how it came up, how the information was spread, and how long it would take to get the information distributed to the people who would want to hear it?
Sure. Well, let me address your point about the word jiaotong, yeah, or the word communications in English. So today, communications means the movement of information, usually disembodied information. So it is not a newspaper or a letter physically moving from place to place, but rather the information it contains. But this difference between the physicality of information and its disembodiedness is a very modern thing, which only really emerges with the wireless. Mm. And even in the English language, the word communications used to mean transportation, traffic, movement. So we see this meaning sometimes in military contexts still, where they talk about cutting off the communications. Doesn't necessarily mean just the information, but also the movement, the roads, the railroads, these kinds of things. Now, if we look at 1919 and we study it from outside of Shanghai, from outside of Beijing, we get a very different understanding of what this event was. Just because the communications were so difficult between different areas of the country and from cities into the countryside. So what I look at in my first case is the case of Sichuan and the city of Chengdu. Now, Chengdu was the capital of Sichuan. It still is the capital of Sichuan. But it didn't really respond to the events of May 4th for 3 or 4 weeks. So why does it take so long for there to be a political movement in Sichuan? And this really has to do with the fact that the information, the news, does not arrive there for a very long time in any substantial way. Why is this the case? Because the telegraph wires were very slow and unreliable. They could only transmit a small amount of information. And so if you're a student sitting there in Chengdu, you really have no concept of what's going on in Beijing beyond just a few words and a basic outline of the story. Intense, large amounts of information only arrive with the steamships when the mail arrives along the Yangtze River and then up its tributary into Chengdu. And this depends on the movement of the ship, which is steam, but also depends on human labor being pulled up through the gorges of the Yangtze River.
You also mentioned an interesting aspect that some of the information that would come quickest was in the form of telegrams or something with just very, very brief, truncated. So the example you give is, this is what a student might receive, you know, in Beijing or something. All Beijing students angry at Cao Rulin and other country sellouts. Crowd went to Trader Cao, asked Cao to answer questions, blah, blah, blah. There's about 5 or 6 sentences there, like headlines, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard to get people riled up about because the information just was like a headline. So people said, I guess what's going on? You needed to have a fleshed out story. So the information came, but it was in such truncated form, people didn't get energized about it.
The best part of that, though, I have to say, is that they actually gave information. It wasn't 5 lines, and the first line was, guess which figure in Beijing had his house burned down? Click here.
That's right.
Not a clickbait type situation. But so this really affects the ways in which politics can be organized in the early 20th century. I mean, this is true for every period in any country. But the fact that you can't get information in certain places, the fact that the rural areas aren't really connected to these information networks, to what I call the newscape, means that those areas are outside of the political system. And so what this book is trying to look at is the process by which rural areas and then urban areas that are not necessarily directly on the coast become integrated into this single socio-political and informational system.
Moving ahead a decade, you make the point in your book that in the 1920s, and I think even point to the year 1923, you have two events. Mm. You have the beginning or the birth of broadcasting in China. And you have more or less at the same time the coalescing of two parties under Leninist party lines, the reorganization of the Kuomintang, the founding, such as it was, of the Chinese Communist Party. And not even between these two rather famous poles of Chinese politics, but even in some parts of China that were outside of this, Beijing, Shanghai, up in the northeast, you have people like Zhang Zuolin, who are also very much interested in the potential and power of broadcasting. Mm. I think, could you talk a little bit about how the coming of wireless or broadcasting technology really starts to transform the political, transform the newscape of China beginning in this 1920s period, which is so critical in China's modern history.
And give an explanation of the word newscape.
Sure. Which, so newscape is a concept that I use throughout the book to refer to the social and geographical and political context of news. It's how news moves both through the country, but also through society. So the important point here is that it is technological, it's geographical, and it's social. And this is a very complex interaction. Information, which I define as any time-sensitive information, has to flow from person to person and interact with culture and also with geography. And it is accelerated or slowed or multiplied or constricted by the technology through which it moves. So that's my definition of newscape. And if we look at the situation in China in 1923, it's a very, very interesting year in Chinese history, and I think overlooked so far in the historiography. Two things happen. One, we have the introduction of radio broadcasting for the first time. And we also have the reorganization of the two existing political parties along Leninist lines. So Sun Yat-sen moves towards the Bolshevik Party, towards the Soviet Union, and agrees to have the Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang, reorganized to become Leninist, and also come into the first united front with the Communist Party. And this happens in the same week of the first broadcast. And actually, Sun Yat-sen, some of his speeches are the very first political broadcasts to be made, only 3 days after the station is founded. And this actually has an influence on his alignment with the Soviet Union, which is announced just the following day after this broadcast. So once we have this technology emerging within China, we have increasing abilities for things like political parties to organize, especially at a local level outside of the major cities. But we don't really see this for another decade until the 1930s. In the 1920s, actually, the place that's dominating the growth of radio broadcasting is the Northeast, which you brought up. And there, Zhang Zuolin and then Zhang Xueliang are embracing radio as this really cool, modernizing way to demonstrate their power and their international influence. And they do have international influence. They are building the world's most powerful radio station. They in Shenyang, in Fengtian. And that radio station is competing with Japan and Germany for the number one spot in the world. And this is really incredible. This is the first government-run radio network anywhere in China. And it's actually not run by either of these Leninist parties, but it's run by a so-called warlord.
Just a quick question on that. As someone who's really interested in the diversity of Chinese dialects and regional right. forms of speech, what are these broadcasts in? Are they something like a Mandarin or... It was just a matter of haphazard matter of who happened to have the microphone, because no matter what language you spoke, there's whole swaths of the country that wouldn't understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, of course. Great question. In Shanghai, some of the broadcasts are in Shanghainese Wu dialect, and then some of the broadcasts are in what would later approximate Guoyu or Putonghua, right? Although, of course, these are concepts that only emerge over the course of right. the 20th century. If we're looking at these northern northeast broadcast systems under the Dongbei regime, they are using Beijing dialect as the standard. So they hire women from Beijing to be the broadcasters. So the very first broadcast that they made was in 1927 out of Tianjin. And the first news announcer that they hired was a woman from Beijing. Mm-hmm. And they said that her accent was very clear. Whatever clear meant to them was a Beijing accent.
Clear for Beijingers. Yeah. You said women.
Yeah.
Can we just skip now to the Yan'an period?
Sure.
We can go back if you want. But the Yan'an period, where they definitely depended on radio for a lot of the propaganda. Mm. And you say in your book from 1941 when the Yan'an broad, what was the name of this station, Yannan, whatever, broadcasting radio, was from 1941 to 1946, all of the announcers were women.
Right.
Now, this is very interesting. You have a chapter called Red Women, Red News or something like that, right? Was that a pun? Red News? Red?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I'm just making sure, right?
The previous chapter is called Reading the Radio, so there's some red.
And if I could jump in there, too, I was really struck by the story of one woman in particular, Ding Yilan, who was, you know, I think, a really great job in the book of, you know, telling the story of this process and also how broadcasting and became very gendered in a way that was different from the rest of the world. In the 1930s, you know, in the West, women are kind of being pushed out of broadcasting for all kinds of bizarre reasons. Mm-hmm. And here we have a woman who's being, you know, kind of at the center of it all. I was wondering if maybe in talking about this, you could also maybe talk a little bit about her career and how she came to kind of be a part of this movement.
Yeah, so she's very, I take her as a representative or an emblem of this fact, which is that women really dominate the Chinese airwaves. This is absolutely true in Yan'an and in the communist movement, but it's also, to some extent, also true of the Nationalist Party. They also have predominantly women announcers. The big question is, why is this the case, right? In the West, we have this very misogynistic movement away from female voices as a voice of authority in public. This is not necessarily true in the early 1920s, but by the 1930s, you don't have any women doing quote-unquote serious news on, let's say, American or British radio. But in China, it's the complete opposite. And there have been many theories proposed for why this is the case. Some have to do with the quality of the broadcast technology or the quality of the receivers. So maybe because women's voices are higher, the technology doesn't necessarily carry their voices as well. But I'm very skeptical of this explanation, because when people don't really take into account the fact that the Chinese people preferred women's voices and thought that they were much clearer. And so we see in the case of China that this technological explanation for why women were pushed out doesn't really hold much water. And in fact, we have to just kind of accept the fact that this was a cultural choice where the Nationalist Party and the Communist Party were trying to, in some ways, demonstrate their global modernity by placing women at the forefront of their representation.
Maybe the reason the Japanese chose Tokyo Rose as the propagandist, women, you know, have a special kind of attractive quality, I guess, especially for men in the trenches. I think what you say is right, but it is true, in fact, that one of the, besides just the register, that higher voices tend to be understood, at least that's in the book, that some of the people, the people who are listening said so, but also the fact that women tend to speak in a wider inflectional range than men do. This is true of all languages, that men, we tend to talk like this because we're men. We don't want to really get excited about things. Right. And women will talk like this because they're not afraid to show their emotions. So in fact, the inflections, that helps in the understanding of tones and the perception, you know, of the intonational aspect of the sentence.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there probably are good reasons why that a woman was just clearer and easier to understand on the radio.
Yeah, so that's the other theory, is that perhaps women spoke with a more exaggerated accent, so that their tones, for instance, would be more exaggerated, and therefore it would be easier to understand exactly what they were saying in the case of a tonal language.
Right.
So I do put forward that aspect of the argument. Mm-hmm. But you bring up a very good counter case, which is the case of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that Japanese is not a very tonal language, although there are some tones.
Yeah.
So why does Japan also have this, not as strong, but slight
preference for female voices?
I think we just have to conclude that this is a cultural thing, right?
It also kind of brings up a point that, you know, we think about the Japanese occupation, that really at a time between 1937 and 1945 as being, you know, a battle of many things, you know, armies.
Yeah.
No, that's true. Logistics. But I think perhaps a less recognized aspect of that era was a battle for the airwaves.
Mm.
And I was wondering, you know, thinking about that, you know, what were some of the ways that the Japanese occupation forces tried to get their message out while blocking competing messages from some of the Chinese entities. How did that work? How did that play out over the course of the war?
Yeah, so broadcasting and news in general was a very important field over the course of the war, as you might imagine. So as the Japanese are invading mostly from the north to the south and from the east to the west, they are capturing radio stations as they go. Some of these radio stations are packed up and shipped inland. So the big case of that is the Nanjing, the capital station for the nationalists, which is partially moved inland. But the majority of stations, including those of Beijing, are captured whole by the Japanese and then turned against the Chinese forces. So they begin broadcasting Japanese propaganda immediately. And over the 7 or 8 years of the war, the Japanese are really working very hard to expand this news network. They are encouraging Chinese people to buy radios. They are manufacturing radios on a very large scale on the model of Nazi Germany. And they are flooding the Chinese market because they believe that they have a very persuasive propaganda program, and that if they can only get people to plug into their newscape, then they will see great success in the ideological battle. And this is a huge problem for Yan'an and for Chongqing, because they have very weak broadcast systems, because they are far in the west. Chongqing is very humid, and it's bad for electronics. So you are not getting a lot of very clear signals out of there. And so really the main way they communicate with the areas under occupation is through mimeographed newspapers, which have a person listening to then copy down the news and then redistribute it at a local level. Mm-hmm. And this is how they try to undermine the Japanese news programs. But yeah, very, very intense battle between those two sides. Mm-hmm.
You know, when we get to the period after, you know, after 1949, presumably one of the things that happens is that, you know, under the new PRC, control over the broadcast mechanisms then falls under the control of the Communist Party. Mm. So we're thinking about the sort of supply side. I'm kind of curious about the consumer side.
Yeah.
How are people listening to the radio, or how are they consuming this broadcast media? Is it everybody? Is it like the picture of a family huddled around the transistor radio at night after dinner? Or is it more like people gathering in the park to listen to megaphones? What does it look like on the ground when people are receiving information?
Yeah, so in terms of receiving sound, most people are doing it publicly through loudspeakers. So like you said, the megaphone in the park, or hanging on the side of a building on a street corner, or in a storefront, especially. This is where people are plugging into the newscape, are receiving this types of this information. In this post-war period, what the Japanese did over the occupation becomes extremely important, because they had flooded the north and the northeast with a lot of radios, Shanghai as well. But the rest of the country has very, very few radios. The areas which the communists take first are the areas which the Japanese had occupied for the longest amount of time. So we're talking about Dongbei, we're talking about Beijing. And in those areas, they had built these powerful radio stations and a large number of receivers. So as soon as those cities fell, the Communist Party had access to this infrastructural network that the Japanese had built. And they used that to their advantage as they marched south through the country. People are very eager to receive news. I mean, this is true from the 1930s and the War of Resistance into the Civil War and later. When we talk about the producer and the consumer side of things, I think this is a very important distinction. And what my book tries to do is to focus on how people experience news as a consumer, not just on the state or institutional side of things, which can be quite dry, I think. Mm-hmm. But understanding how people desire news, how people reorganize their daily life in order to receive more news, the ways in which people prefer technological and political systems that give them more information, I think explains a lot about how these wars and these political movements evolve.
Two aspects that's on your, in your book, and it was very interesting to me because it intersected with my experience when I first came to to China in 1986 at Peking University, which you're at now, teaching at that university. One is the annoying morning loudspeakers that would wake you up at 6 a.m. and you had the Ti Chao, which we've talked about in a past podcast, you know, and 6 a.m. and people getting up and doing these mass, you know, exercises. But then also, you know, during the day, there would be news and propaganda or campus news and whatever. And the other thing is, in the 80s, China was battling with the shortwave because there was the Voice of America and other foreign stations that could get information in China. So they were there was always an attempt to scramble the shortwave signal, which somehow people circumvented because people were learning a lot of English from the VOA, especially the Voice of America in special English. You know, I love to listen to those because, you know, it was so tedious, but people really did learn about a lot of English that way. But it seems like those two things were aspects of the Mao period very early. It seems like after the 1980s, the loudspeakers in the universities kind of went away as the forms of communication become more varied and complex. To my consternation, it seems like they're coming back.
Still exist. About 2 or 3 days ago, in the evening, I was walking around Weiminghu, and I listened to a play about the War of Resistance being broadcast on the loudspeaker system. A very overwrought play, very overacted.
Is there any other kind?
Given what most students generally do around Wei Minghu, that can't have fostered the romantic notions appropriate to their intended activity.
Well, they also commit suicide there, so maybe, you know, that might, you know. Anyway.
That got dark quick.
There was a sick baby and a doctor trying to save the baby. It had everything you wanted in a War of Resistance play. But so these loudspeaker systems still exist to some extent. They've never completely gone away. But the loudspeaker systems are exactly what you say. They are a way to control what moves through these systems of communication. Because if you have a loudspeaker system, you have one central control.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So these were built all over the country. You have literally tens of millions of loudspeakers.
Yeah, all the work units, factories, schools.
Right. Every school has one. Because you're controlling it from a central place, it doesn't have the same danger of listening to VOA or something like that, which would be a big no-no, put it that way.
Right.
So yeah, these systems are built with certain goals in mind. And this is why I think that the technology and the politics has to be understood dialectically. In other words, that there are two forces that constantly are in tension but interact, and you can't really separate one from the other. Mm.
Back to the shortwave, though.
Yeah.
What was interesting to me in your book was that because it was such a propaganda disaster that Chairman Mao would actually send out a small group of specialists technicians who could deal with shortwave radios and either reduce the range, their reception range, or actually just disable them or get rid of them altogether. So this was interesting that a new kind of technology arose that you would think most countries would take advantage of, at least to get their own message out, because shortwave, you know, travels outside of boundaries, cultural borders. But this is a case where they're actually clamping down on a new kind of technology. And the same thing in the 1980s, the sort of trying to disable this new technology precisely because it went over international boundaries.
Right. So the key thing to understand about shortwave is that the waves travel much farther. Mm-hmm. So the reason why shortwaves are so sensitive is because you can broadcast from, let's say, San Francisco or from Tokyo, and those shortwaves can arrive in China. But that's not true of medium waves. Let's say, you know, what we might consider FM broadcasting.
Right.
And so it's much safer to have only FM broadcasting. So when there are very few numbers of radios, it's easy to go around and, as you say, fiddle with the physical radio mechanism, the receiver, and disable it from receiving these shortwave signals, and thereby restrict what's able to come into people's ears.
But this seems to have echoes of the very newest technology, which is the internet, which they are also welcome as a new, you know, communications tool, but also try to control it.
Yes, I think of it less as in terms of its control and more of it in terms of building it out in a different direction. So yes, there is this block on a certain avenue of development, of technological development, like shortwave or certain aspects of the internet, but there's an explosion of development in other aspects. So you have the wired networks being built in 1950s and 1960s China, and you have the Chinese intranet being built today, which is massive and filled with content and filled with things that Chinese people enjoy using. It's important to understand it as a redirection rather than a blockage, because otherwise we can't really understand how people actually experience it. Mm-hmm. If we think of it only as a blockage, then it might be mysterious to us why people aren't angry about it. But if we think of it as an alternate development, we can more easily understand people's reaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, thank you so much for joining us today. The title of the book, Seeking News, Making China Information Technology and the Emergence of Mass Society. It's out from Stanford University Press. And we hope to have you back again.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Hopefully next year at AAS, we can have a panel on this book.
Yes,
or related things. That would be great.
Yeah.
Well, David, I hope you get some rest before you
I'm asleep right now, by the way. You probably didn't notice, but I'm doing this in my sleep.
Well, you're doing a good job. And thank you all for listening. Please join us again on our next episode, coming, I would guess, sometime in early April. And as we say, cue the drums.